to Is Able, the radio show about possibility, where we look at what a person with disabilities can do rather than what they cannot do. Hello, this is Dr. Stephen Nurse, and this is an episode in our series on the war in Vietnam. And just a little recap, one of the things that we really wanted to do in this series was not to talk political, but to talk about how war and the Vietnam War and essentially all wars affect people. When you consider the fact that there were almost 20,000 people or 20,000 soldiers that were killed that had families. So for each, even each person that is, who was killed in Vietnam, there are probably 20 people, aunts and uncles and brothers and sisters and children and wives that were also affected. And I think that that is something that really needs to be looked at. All we saw on the news each night were body counts with Walter Cronkite. And, there were literally millions of Vietnamese that were also killed in this war and that also had families. Today, we're going to try and look at Vietnam from a historical standpoint and look at some of those components that really led to the war and some of the things that happened during the war and then after the war. And we will also be discussing in later issues just what happened to folks after they transitioned back into the United States. Today we have two guests with us, and one is Dr. Bruce Hallman. He lives on Vashon Island. He's a historian. If he was on Jeopardy and the main topic would be Vashon Island, he would probably be the all-greatest time money winner on that. He's taught the history of the war in Vietnam and is an expert on the Vashon history. Somebody even told me that there were at one time two time zones on Vashon. Two.
Well, yeah. Actually, it came about when there was a in the 1920s and 30s, when they went to daylight savings times, parts of the island decided they did not want to follow the model of the state and Seattle. And so part of the island remained on standard time, while the other part of the island was on daylight time, which made havoc for the ferries. And of course, the ferries at that time were the Mosquito Fleet boats.
Right.
So you had to figure out the Mosquito Fleet boats leaving Tacoma were on standard time, and the ones leaving Seattle were on daylight time. So
it also sounds like the kind of issue that people on Vashon could really get their teeth into.
Oh, yes. Vashon's always been contentious, to say the least.
So Mr. Hallman is going to discuss the history of many years of the Vietnam War, and also with us as our expert and Vietnam veteran, Chris Gaynor. And Chris has been on several other of the episodes. Let's first talk a little bit about the timeline of the war. You know, in this country, we think about the war from about 63 when we sent in advisors. But it really was a lot. Vietnam has kind of always been in war, you know.
It's a thousand-year war, you know.
Yeah.
I was in Vietnam as a Fulbright scholar in the early 90s. And I was just, you know, even though I'd studied the war, going there and sort of going through the museums. And, I mean, for the Vietnamese, it's the American war. You know, there was a French war. There was a Chinese war. You know, there's Chinese wars going on right now with Vietnam, but it was the American war. And it, I really expected to see some animosity still, but there was very little of that, at least in Saigon and Hanoi and the larger cities. It was a sense that it was just a stage in the movement toward Vietnamese independence.
You know, that's really interesting you said that, because one of my friends that we're going to be interviewing pretty soon is a guy named Dave Watson. And Dave is graduated with me in Ellensburg. He was in the military. He was in Germany during the Vietnam War. But he, for a project he was working on, he moved to Vietnam and lives in Ho Chi Minh City, and married a Vietnamese woman and has several children. And the interesting thing is that's exactly what he said. He said he, you know, as a veteran and as an American, he said he was not treated badly. There was no animosity. He said that the war for the Vietnamese was more of a matter of fact. You know, it was a job that you did. It was a job that we had all through our lives. And, you know, he also mentioned that he was treated well. And so that is kind of interesting that happened. Why were the French there?
Well, for resources. I mean, you know, the French go into Vietnam in the 1880s, essentially, as a colonial empire, establishing the French colonial empire. And at the time, I mean, you know, a number of resources. The North is, and the North and the South are two very different countries. You know, the South is largely agricultural. It's relatively flat. You know,
rice
wet.
Paddies.
Yeah, rice paddies. The North is mountainous. It's more industrial, and minerals. I mean, you know, actually, the French battle at Dien Bien Phu was over a major mining area, the extraction of minerals, and of course, in the South of part of Vietnam, rubber. In the late 19th, early 20th centuries, were very important to the French. And it was, I mean, not to get way off base, but, you know, the French had a particular way of colonizing that was very different from the British, very different from the Belgians, very different from Holland. And the French sort of system of colonization tended to have everything done by Frenchmen. So even down to local postal deliveries were done by the French, not by local Vietnamese. In Britain, in India, for instance, Britain ran India with about 800, you know, bureaucrats, and sort of farmed out all the jobs to local Indians. And so what you get are two different colonial systems. And in Vietnam in particular, it became a system in which the Vietnamese people had no sort of engagement within running their own country. And that goes back to the Chinese invasions, you know, of the 200s and 300s.
Yes. So. Probably 25 years ago, my wife and I supported or sponsored a Laotian family that came to the United States. And the family could speak Laotian, but also could speak French. And so that's what he wound up doing, was working at Highline College and translating and doing that kind of thing.
Sure.
And so the French were in there, and then when didn't they leave about the end of... end of the 50s or?
Well, mid-50s. You know, Dien Bien Phu is 54, and that's sort of the collapse of the, you know, the French Indochina. And that's really when Southeast Asia gets sort of carved up into North and South Vietnam, the demilitarized zone essentially established. Laos, Cambodia are all carved out of what was once one sort of independent French Indochina.
And I think many of the folks, you know, my age, when I think about that, I remember seeing, you know, newsreels in the movie theaters on the French leaving and the French wars there, and also, you know, like I said, on the body counts. Mm-hmm. But now, was the war more in the North or was it in the South at that time?
It was scattered. I mean, Dien Bien Phu is in the north, and Dien Bien Phu becomes sort of the turning point for the French, and actually leads to the French withdrawal. I mean, the French were so desperate at Dien Bien Phu, they actually requested American nukes come in and be used against the Vietnamese.
Is that right?
Yeah,
wow.
So, and of course, the Americans refused nuclear weapons. You know, that's another whole complex sort of thing.
Right, but, sure.
But, you know, to me, looking back at the Vietnam War, Dien Bien Phu becomes perhaps the pivotal sort of point, because it really showed the resolution of the Vietnamese Liberation Army in terms of fighting against these colonial oppressors. And when the French moved out in 54, you know, essentially, nobody moved in until the Americans began to move in with support troops, you know, advisors at that time.
And were they advising? They were advising the South Vietnamese. Is that
yes,
correct? Okay.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah.
You know,
because
that was the other thing that I remembered was seeing on the news, they would show Russia and China on the map. And then you would see all the dominoes falling. I remember seeing that picture perfectly.
Yep,
and of course, it was. And of course, then in America, you know, that was during the Cold War time, and that was that would have been the next step. Would you know, they're going to be in our backyard.
Mm-hmm.
So
right. Yep.
So may I? Go ahead. Go ahead.
I want to just drop a little footnote in here about the French Michelin. Mm-hmm. Rubber company, which made tires, best tires in the world at the time. When I was there in 1967-68, I was based at Dao Tieng, which was a Michelin rubber plantation, still in operation, with a French manager who had a deal with the Viet Cong and the NVA. If you blow my tree up, you pay me $300. We had the same deal. We blew up a lot of trees, and we paid a lot of $300. Well, now it's a reservoir. They covered it completely gone. But our tour guide, when we were over there in 2013, said all the well-connected people grabbed the rubber plantations after the war in 1975, and they're rich now.
I'm sure that's true.
Yeah.
I know in King County, if you cut out a tree, you're in big trouble too. So,
well, you know, it's kind of odd. You know, it's a war going on. A short round would hit and blow up the tree.
Yeah. And, you know, I just hope they counted all those blown up trees correctly, you know. So
well, you know, that was the deal.
They got paid the right amount and everything.
You know.
Yeah.
He had his own plane and, you know, he nobody shot at him. He was free to fly wherever he wanted to.
Yeah. That's it. I've also, I'm going to stop saying that's interesting every time that you guys make a comment, but that is interesting. So the Americans then came in about in 63. I think wasn't the first American that was killed there was in 63.
Yeah, but again, the sort of what happens is really you have American advisors coming into Vietnam, in the south part of Vietnam. Vietnam's divided in 1954, north and south. You know, north is clearly is aligned with China and the Soviet Union. The south is aligned with the U.S. And that really sets up the sort of coming conflict, you know, 10 years later. But what you have in 65 is when you get the sending of U.S. troops to Vietnam. 3,500 Marines land to protect the air bases. At that time, there were already 23,000 American advisors in Vietnam, sort of the secret war, if you will, that was going on
right.
from 1954 to 1965 that nobody really knew about and was not publicized at all. And it was all American advisors, a lot of CIA, had previously been the strategic services kind of stuff.
And don't you think that those...
Go ahead,
those
Chris.
Advisors were doing a lot more than advising.
Oh, of course.
If you read a book about John Paul Vann, Colonel Vann,
right.
Who was very pro South Vietnam and right. Republic of Vietnam. He led combat missions,
right.
and he, you know, he wasn't supposed to be doing that, but
no.
he did.
Right. Yeah. No. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's. I think that that's kind of what. And that was Kennedy. Was it right. Nixon or was it really Kennedy that? was involved at that time.
It's really Eisenhower, you know, right. 54, 55, you know, the, right. when it starts and sort of that first sort of support of the South Vietnamese.
He was a military government. Guy, so we had the right. Korean War. We got that over with. We right. needed to have some kind of a war.
Got to have an interim war before we start.
This would be a good place. Right. You know, it's warm climate and... Right. You know, but
definitely, you know, from Eisenhower into Kennedy and the buildup, the big buildup came in the early 60s as the North Vietnamese became more aggressive.
So it was kind of almost hidden that the families must have known they were over there, obviously.
Not a lot. It was that they were advisors. Colonel. Was he a colonel? I'm trying to remember. Van.
Colonel
Van. Military guy, but he's there as a civilian, you know, and mm-hmm. so he's off.
At that time, he was actually detached as a military.
As a military advisor.
But later, he came back as a civilian.
He died
as a civilian.
Right. Yeah. But it was pretty hidden, you know, even from families, you know, the dads would.
And
be
what
often,
was their purpose you mentioned that, you know, combat, but were they, protecting the air bases? Is that what they were purposely there for?
Well, that's when the first 3,500 Marines that came in and landed in Vietnam and, you know, photo ops, you know, sort of like D-Day landing kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
That was the first sort of commitment of combat troops to Vietnam. And that was to protect the air bases. That was pretense. And of course, I mean, within... you know, that was 3,500 troops. Within a year, there were over 200,000 troops in Vietnam.
Within a year?
Yep. So over. It built very, very quickly. Yep.
And when the Americans had those advisors in, though, the 3,500, mm-hmm. Was there a pretty immediate response to that also from North Vietnamese? Or why the buildup so fast? What was the threat?
Well, what was happening is that there was... You have to back off and remember that this is a civil war, you know, and the division
right.
was a, you know, an artificial division. And what happened in 54 is a whole lot of North Vietnamese who were Roman Catholic and not Buddhist mm-hmm. moved to the South. So you had this incredible population displacement in the mid-1950s as a result of this dividing Vietnam into North and South. And the divisions were... partly class lines, partly economic lines, but the biggest line was religion, because the South was ruled by Roman Catholic Vietnamese. The North was ruled by communist, you know, Buddhist.
Now, is that partly influenced from the French, too? Because the French, there are a lot of the, right. you know, Catholic religion is fairly right. prominent in France.
Right. Yes. Oh, yeah, right.
So...
Yeah. Oh, definitely, yeah, and what you see largely is that it was middle and upper class Vietnamese who were Roman Catholic, you know, working class peasants, agricultural Vietnamese were largely Buddhist. I mean, not totally. It's like any place, but there were class distinctions that followed these religious distinctions.
And when they brought in these 225,000, mm-hmm. That must have at least hit the press pretty big at that point, or did
oh, yeah.
it not?
Oh, yeah. Remember, it's late 64 that the Gulf of Tonkin resolution is passed.
Right.
And that sort of gives Johnson, you know, unfettered ability to wage war in Vietnam. And then a few months later, they send these 3,500 Marines in to protect air bases. And then as they're put under pressure... You know, I mean, the rationale becomes, well, we're protecting our own troops, we're protecting our own bases, we're protecting our advisors, and it just becomes a rolling ball, of building up the effort in Vietnam.
Now, the Gulf of Tonkin must have been in the fall, wasn't it?
Yeah, I'm trying to look at the date of the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. I think it was in, let me look.
Because I remember, it seems like I was at my uncle's house.
It was August 7th, 1964.
Yeah. And so. I remember I was at my uncle's house on Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really that Tonkin Resolution and all that stuff was was really big news at that that time. And the boat when the boat was taken.
Okay. So that the Gulf of Tonkin incident was actually August 2nd and 4th, two incidences of 64. The resolution is passed on August 7th. So by March 5th, you know, basically within 6 months is when the first combat troops are sent in.
And it must have also just been massive, because if you're taking in 225,000 troops, I mean, you got to bring a couple cans of beans for them, too, and some bullets and all those things.
Yeah, the logistics buildup was just amazing. And the things that go along with it that we don't even think about. I mean, the U.S. government came in, and by 1966, 67, they had nearly a dozen ice cream factories in Vietnam.
Wow.
To feed U.S. troops ice cream. You know, I mean, what are you going to do? You're not going to ship ice cream across the Pacific.
No.
And you come into a culture where there's not a whole lot of dairy products. You know, a lot of Asian people don't digest dairy well.
Lactose, yeah.
Lactose intolerance, is a genetic feature for a lot of Asian people. So you come into a culture that's not used to having a lot of milk and milk products. All of a sudden, you get 250 up to ultimately almost 600,000 Americans who want ice cream. it's fascinating.
We wanted beer more than ice cream.
Well, beer more than ice cream. Right. But that's another story, right?
You could combine the two and have beer-flavored ice cream.
Yes, exactly.
That would also work. But, you know, I know my father got out of, I guess is a proper term, World War II, because he worked in a dairy factory, and they made powdered milk, and that was his specialty. So that's what he did. And so 12 ice cream factories, and I and every veteran that I've talked to has told me that their ice cream cones would probably melt pretty fast over there. Is that right, Chris?
Yes,
104 degrees, 104% humidity.
Right. Yeah.
In the shade.
And as I think it was one of our other folks we talked to, I think it was Mr. Burka, who said that when he got off the plane, you could chew the atmosphere.
Yeah, he was a great line. I like his.
Right. You could chew the atmosphere.
You could chew the air.
And I think everybody, in fact, that's the one of the common things.
Yeah. It's the first thing I say in my first letter.
Yeah.
I feel like I swim through the thick air.
Yeah.
Right.
And I asked one of my other veteran friends, I said, what was your first impression? And he said, we actually got off the plane and had to immediately go out and guard around the perimeter of the airport and said, I knew I was here.
Right.
Interesting that you mentioned kind of the secret part of it, too, because a lot of the guys that I talked to said, we knew we were in Vietnam, but we really didn't know, other than a name, we really didn't know where we were in Vietnam. We didn't know if we were close to there was a large buildup by the Cambodian border.
Right.
Because now, doesn't the Ho Chi Minh Trail go through Cambodia and through
parts of Laos, Cambodia, the eastern parts?
Let's talk about that, the Ho Chi Minh Trail, because I find that fascinating in that the Americans bombed that numerous times.
Oh, constantly.
Right. They bombed it constantly, and they were knocking out large sections of it, but there were so many. I mean, it kind of reminds me when I see these pictures of
ants.
Best way to think about it is if you've been up in the Cascade and seen a braided river, you know, the typical rivers that come out of the Cascade Mountains or any large mountains, you know, they end up to be relatively broad, flat, gravel rivers with multiple channels. And that's really the way to think of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And not only was it bombed, but that was one of the major reasons Agent Orange was introduced to Vietnam to defoliate the Ho Chi Minh Trail so they could see where the trail was.
And Chris, did you want to say something about that?
Because I was just going to footnote that because I was in Three Corps, which was Saigon to the Cambodian border west, and the Ho Chi Minh Trail emptied right into our lap, right into where we were operating. And underground was the complete shadow government. All the ministers were all the buried under tunnels, which had electricity, surgery rooms, doctors, hospitals. They had everything. We didn't know. It was so deep and well dug in.
And these had been built probably when the French were there.
Yes.
Very early. Yeah. Right. And Chris, you probably don't mind me saying this, but you have Parkinson's.
Yes.
And that's a result of Agent Orange.
Yeah. The Veterans Administration determined that my Parkinson's is related to exposure to Agent Orange. And if you look at my pictures from 1967 at Camp Mountain Martin Cox, my first base camp, they scraped, first of all, they sprayed everything full strength until it killed it. Then they scraped it. And we put us in there, and we were soaked with it by the airplane. We lived in it, we breathed it, we ate it, and it killed. I'm one of the few guys left in my unit who hasn't died from complications from Agent Orange.
One of the things that I think you mentioned that would, to me, would make that worse is, you know, first they sprayed it, and then just to make sure they kind of scraped everything got all the dust in the air. My neighbor, who was a pilot, said he remembers landing in literally clouds of the Agent Orange. No, it had dioxin in it.
Dioxin.
And that's the same thing that's in Roundup,
I think.
Do we have any idea how many people that the veterans have that are listed as having their disability related to Agent Orange?
Millions. There are millions. And I almost every one of my buddies has some disease or condition that's related. Ischemic heart disease, certain type of diabetes, all this. I have multiple things. It's going to kill me one of these days, you know, not today, but maybe next week or next year. You know, it's really poisonous. And, you know, I didn't know at the time, you know, I just did what I was told. And we ate it, we smelled it, it was all over us, and it was terrible.
And it sounds like, did they know at that time that it was this dangerous?
Yeah, they probably did, but you know, chemical companies aren't necessarily the most.
Transparency is not their strong suit.
No,
but also, I mean, they actually, and I've actually seen photographs and newsreels where they had guys just sort of dosing themselves with Agent Orange to show how harmless it was.
Yeah, sure.
You know. So, I mean, again, there was a whole propaganda campaign by the military within the military to convince people like Chris that this was not a danger.
Maybe those in those ice cream factories, those creamsicles were, colored orange with that. Well, I think at that we're going to take a break here, and we'll be right back with another 30 minutes of this show. So thank you very much. Oh, that was good. Hello, and welcome to Is Able. Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse. We're back for our second half, and I guess if I was in Vietnam right now, which I'm not, I would say this is Adrian Cronauer. Hello, Vashon. We're going to talk a little bit more about the war. And one of the things that we talked during the break was that this was really a relatively short war as far as you know, America has, if you compare it to what the Afghanistan war started in the 90s and is still going on. Talk about that a little bit, please, Bruce.
Yeah, I think it's from the Vietnamese perspective. I mean, it was a 1,000-year-long struggle to get independence, first from China, and then from France, and then from the Americans. But in essence, for the American war, I mean, it occurred very, very quickly. I mean, Gulf of Tonkin incident is in August of 64. First American troops, other than advisors, are land in March of 65. And the Tet Offensive, which is sort of the peak of the war, is in January of 68. So in a matter of 2.5-3 years, what we think of as the Vietnam War largely took place. I mean, of course, a long denouement after Tet. We're not formally out of there until 65, but we moved from almost 600,000 troops down to like 150,000 troops by 71. So it's a very quick timeline.
When we talk about the first buildup of 50,000, mm-hmm. and the logistics involved in that.
Sure.
I mean, to bring that many more in is it's just amazing. And also, the pictures that I've seen, Cu Chi and around the air bases. Mm-hmm. I mean, they had buildings. They mm-hmm. had bunk buildings. They had my friends that worked on the Chinook helicopters. Mm-hmm. They had just all the testing equipment for autopilots. I mean, it's... And it looks like it's all kind of built to be, with handles on it, to be, hauled in there. And somebody must have thought about it. And in a war, somebody always makes a lot of money off the war, too. And, those suppliers.
Right.
Talk about the Vietnamese, kind of their approach to the war. We talked that they just, it's been going on forever for them. It's no big deal.
Yeah, and it's sort of... I mean, there's an old adage, in effect, that low-tech beats high-tech every time in warfare. And that's something that the Americans sort of forgot. I mean, and it goes back to Dien Bien Phu. I mean, one of the reasons for the French disaster in Dien Bien Phu is actually in a valley. And the French generals were so convinced that the Vietnamese could never get cannons, up to the high grounds, that they sort of built this military base in the bottom of the valley. Well, I mean, what the Vietnamese did is they took these cannons apart and they hand carried them up piece by piece, reassembled them, and then they just, they obliterated the French and forced the French to surrender. If you take that as a model, that's essentially what happened in the South with the Americans. Mm-hmm. We brought in a lot of technology. But we could not defeat the low technology of the Vietnamese people and resistance, the sort of broad spread resistance among the Vietnamese people.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but, I just got through reading the book, Germs, Guns, and Steel. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what they also said in that book was it wasn't who had the biggest army. It was who had the healthiest army. Right. And malaria and some of the, jungle rot and the environment that the Americans were not used to must have had a pretty big effect on that, too. Is that correct? Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. And Chris, you can talk.
I still have
that.
Food rot from mm-hmm. 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. It'll never go away because it's in my system. Right. I did not get malaria, fortunately. But I had all kinds of other stuff. When I got out, I had chloracne, and I had all the Agent Orange associated, and I had depression and all kinds of weird things. But we were not very healthy. We didn't eat. We ate sea rations, or we ate. Sometimes we had full meals if we came into base camp, and we drank a lot of beer. It was terrible beer because it got stale sitting on the dock. So we would go to Cu Chi to pick up supplies, and we go to Filipino camp. They were engineers, and they would party us. They would get San Miguel beer, which was wonderful, and they had fresh food, And we partied. And, of course, they had a little funny smoke cigarettes. Funny cigarettes. And one time we got, I took my crew in there. And I was the sergeant, a team chief. And I took my crew in there. We partied all day. And we missed the convoy back to Daltier. And you don't want to be on Highway 1 when it gets dark. I put my two guys in back, protecting our flank, put Mikey in the shotgun, and I drove with pedal to metal. We made it without any problem. They closed the gate behind us at Daltier, and they never said anything.
One of the gentlemen that I talked to, one of the who is a veteran on the island, decided he did not want to be interviewed, but he had some really good, poignant stories. And I asked him if I could relate some of those. And one of the things that he said, he was apparently had been out in the bush, was trying to get back with his group, and he found a garbage truck going, a 2.5-ton garbage truck going someplace. And so he hopped a ride on the garbage truck. And he said he found a can of, must have been left over from a holiday, a ration can of fruitcake. Now, you know, some people can be fans of fruitcake, but, you know, I would take a burrito first. But he said that he dug through this garbage and found this can of fruitcake, and he ate it. And, in fact, he said I could use his name. This is Art Rack.
Right.
And he said that it was the best fruitcake.
Mm-hmm, sure.
That he had ever eaten.
It was the only fruitcake in Vietnam.
Yeah, it was the only fruitcake.
There's only one, you know.
That's right. It was.
It circles the world.
Yes, and I think that says something, too. And
It's reflective of that disconnect between what the leaders and the generals and the military planners in the United States sort of saw this war as, and what people, you know, actually fighting the war and once they arrived in country experienced. Mary Ann Jacobs, a nurse in Vietnam that Chris knows, that I talked with, tells a great story about when she and her cadre of nurses flew into Vietnam. They flew into a major airbase, landed on the tarmac, and some incoming mortar rounds were coming in. And so here they are dressed in heels and nylons and wearing skirts, and they're running across the airfield being mortared, trying to get to safety. And, I mean, you know, within a week, all of that stuff's out the door, and they're wearing fatigues, and they're, you know, they're doing triage in these tent hospitals. And it's sort of like they were not prepared for what they were going to encounter. And I think you talk to veterans time and time again. Nobody was prepared for what Vietnam was really like. And it was because of that disconnect. The leaders here had no concept of what that war was or what it was about.
And I think one of the things that I've seen is how creative the veterans were. Taking a little piece of C4 to heat your rations.
Yeah, that's right.
Doing things like that. Mm-hmm. And also, the Viet Cong, were creative in that they used many of the things that were thrown away by the Americans or were left in the battlefield, these booby traps where they would put, Chris, maybe you can talk about that. They would put an M16 bullet in a little pipe and then have
a nail
that underneath it so that if someone stepped on it, that it would ignite the bullet.
And go right to their foot.
And you said you told me the purpose was to what?
Get that troop off the battlefield and into somewhere else where he would not be able to fight. They didn't care. If he didn't kill them, they didn't care. Because if they killed him, they'd have to go and do something with the body. This way, he's gone and he's not a threat anymore. And so they had all kinds of nasty punji sticks and stuff that would go into your foot. Wouldn't kill you, but they had the ones that would kill you, the bouncing Bettys. You step on it when you left your foot. It comes up and it explodes in your face. You are dead.
The picture that I sent you this morning with this, and this also shows how creative they were. This was not the Ho Chi Minh Trail, but this was the Mekong Delta. And they were watching this boat with kind of mom and pop on it, and it had firewood on it. And they, one of the, my graduate friends, one of the people in their group said, that boat is really sitting low in the water. And so they tried to get the boat over, you know, chuhoy, chuhoy, and the boat took off. And the picture that I sent to you, Chris, has all of the, underneath this bamboo carpet, I could not believe, and I know how big sandbags are, I could not believe how they had mortars, they had the bouncing Bettys, they had artillery shells, they had mortar launchers, and I'm surprised that thing didn't sink. So
my job was to, one of my main jobs was to take the intel from the forward observers who would see something like that. And they, once they said, yes, this has got ammo, we would, I would call in an airstrike, and they would, we put a 105 millimeter howitzer right in the middle of it and blow the whole thing.
Yeah.
In the middle of the night.
So, and I think that was the thing, was that they had every, when you see these old Vietnamese films of the people marching up the Ho Chi Minh Trail, there, like you said, there were thousands of them.
Right.
And a lot of them were carrying, you know, one or two mortar shells at a time.
Yep.
And now, you mentioned that, you know, it was like this, these streams. Was there one Ho Chi Minh Trail? I mean, that sounds like a naive question.
Yeah, no. I mean, yeah, I mean.
Not like the Yellow Brick Road,
yeah,
right?
No, no, there's not one Ho Chi Minh Trail. I mean, the Ho Chi Minh Trail was really a network of trails.
Okay.
And very sophisticated, and lots of stopping off places, lots of places to sequester gear, to high gear along the way. And like you said earlier, I mean, it was, people would be carrying one or two items, but the number of people involved, it just created this huge sort of inflow of material that the Americans would bring in airplanes or in big cargo ships and unload. I mean, the Vietnamese were doing the same thing, but it was one piece at a time. And so the Americans were really set up for that and could never really, I mean, a lot of the actions that Chris was involved in that sort of east-western part of Vietnam was to interdict the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And they never did. They couldn't shut it down because it wasn't one road.
Kind of like flowing water.
Exactly.
Did you want to say something, Chris?
Well, a B-52 would blow up an entire section of Ho Chi Minh Trail, and 24 hours later, it'd be all ready to go again with the trucks. And of course, they'd blow up bridges. The Vietnamese would rebuild the bridge overnight. Right. We were just outsmarted completely.
Yeah.
We were fighting a war with big machines, air power, B-52 bombers, artillery, napalm, and they were punji sticks. You know, they were getting us one at a time, and we were really making the wrong tactical decision.
One of my we talked to another person, and one thing he mentioned was that the Vietnamese had the material, had these whether they were mortars or whether they were explosives or guns, they had them in so many places. Whereas he's on guard duty one night, he's looking over at Cu Chi, and he sees the sky just turn orange. You can't hear anything. They're too far away. But basically, a sapper got in there and got a place where they stored all the weaponry.
Right.
And destroy one weaponry like that, you basically disable the whole a whole army for a long time. Whereas if you have that in 1,000 different places, right, like my friend said, we found one hooch that had a lot of things underneath it, mm-hmm, but you know, that's one out of many. And I think Chris is really right when he says we maybe got outsmarted.
We were outsmarted. We were out tactically, outsmarted tactically, because strategically we had this idea of moving them, of body count and reducing the enemy to the point where they would give up. Well, that didn't work, and so we went to a tactical. But you know, a lieutenant colonel and battalion commander in the field who's good, knows what he's doing, imitates the Vietnamese, the Viet Cong. He'll do exactly what they do. He'll dig in, and then he'll hit the, he'll surround him and hit him at 3 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, that's what we did.
A lot of it goes back to, I mean, it's an adage you hear a lot. The military is always set to fight the war that was just, they just fought. And the Americans very much went into this with a World War II Korean War mentality. And this war was unlike those kind of wars. I mean, this was truly a revolution. It was a guerrilla war. It was something the American military was just not prepared for. And I think as a result, when you look at what's happened since the Vietnam War, mm-hmm, is the American military has sort of inured itself with this idea is that the shock and awe is going to win the war. And that's what you see in the Middle East. That's what you see in the Gulf War. That's what you see in the Afghan War. And the problem with shock and awe is it wins the first couple weeks of the war. But when the war goes on for 10 years or 15 years or 20 years, you know, it's not going to win the war.
I find when you mentioned that, we talked about guerrilla warfare. Mm-hmm. If you think about the revolution in this country with the British, right, it kind of seems like
there's parallels.
Very similar in that right, the Americans had bad weapons. They didn't have things that they did. The British had all the firepower, but the British sat up in troops of 20, right, and had one guy load and shoot, and then the guys would kneel and they'd stand in a line. And that was a very gentlemanly way to die, I guess. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The Americans were the guerrillas. Exactly. They shot four or five people and took off and ran into the woods. Right. And yep, and from everything that I've talked to Chris about, that's exactly, you know, how this war was conducted. That they, right, you know, hit and leave.
Right.
Is that true,
yeah,
Chris?
Yeah, that's true. And you know, you can read books by really good, well-trained field grade officers, Americans, who tell you how to do it. Here's how you win. And in the senior staff at headquarters, MACV or headquarters in D.C., ignored it because they didn't want to do it that way. It didn't fit their preconception of World War II, the way you come in and you liberate, you know. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, and I think that. So I said I wouldn't get political, and I'm not going to, but do you think that, Bruce, do you think that, because I've heard the statement, wars need to be conducted by warriors and not politicians. Mm-hmm. Was that part of the problem in Vietnam? Was that there was, you know, they declare these no fire zones, or they would. In fact, when they found this sandpan, it was during a, they got in trouble for shooting at it because it was at a time when there was supposed to be a ceasefire.
Right. Yeah. 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 I mean, that's always, yeah. I mean, essentially, yes. I mean, politicians shouldn't be running wars. The problem is that warfare is politics in another form. Mm-hmm. Going back to the Clausewitz kind of definition of warfare. So you need to think about that. And every war has political constraints on it. The difficulty is, you know, how much latitude are you going to give the military leaders to fight the war that they're fighting? And I think Chris pointed this out as well, is that the military leaders, those who weren't in the field, did not understand this war and were fighting a very different kind of war and leading a very different kind of war and, in effect, hamstringing the leaders in the field. And then you add to that the politicians. And so what you get is essentially an unwinnable war. Chris, you might want to add to that.
Well, one thing I was going to say, we haven't talked about it, but journalists.
Right.
Journalists from all the big networks, TV networks, and the print media, a lot of them, I'd say the majority of them, got all their information from the briefing in the evening at MACV and in Saigon. They didn't go in the field. They weren't going to get hurt.
Nope.
So they'd regurgitate
exactly
this untruth. Mm-hmm. You know, the military sat there and say, oh, we killed, 400 VC and we destroyed their,
right.
And it was four VC,
yeah.
And not 400.
Yeah, right.
And so when we did body counts, it was swing them a big hole, and they dig a hole, swing them one, two, three, four, and then it's one body and four people.
Right. Yep. Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So again, that disconnect between what's happening in the field, yep. What's happening with military leaders mm-hmm. at the top in Vietnam and in D.C., and then with the politicians.
Mm-hmm. When do you think that the Americans knew that we probably couldn't win the war and we better get our tails out of here?
February 1st, 1968. They right. saw it on the TV. They saw yes. William Westmoreland standing in the compound of the embassy, scared to death. Mm-hmm. And his Marines dead around him, and he didn't know what to do because right. he said we were going to be done by then. What right. happened?
So that was the Tet Offensive in
1968.
Yeah. And that brought home to not only a lot of the military leaders, but to the American public.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the time that Walter Cronkite made his famous sort of statement about this war is not being won.
He did it. It was
this war is not winnable. Yes.
Right. Westmoreland pounded the nail in and Cronkite finished it off. Pounded it all the way in and it was done. You aren't going to get any more money out of Congress
right.
to fund a war that was obviously going the wrong way.
Right, yeah.
And, yeah. And so at that point, then they decided to get out and start making plans for that. But how do you get out and save face? I don't
You sent Henry Kissinger to Paris. And instead of sitting around the table with the negotiators, he goes to a secret home in the outskirts of Paris, and they work out a real proper deal.
Mm-hmm.
The right. two of them, he and the best negotiator that Li Xuan sent down.
Right.
And they had a deal, and they signed it, and they didn't stick to it, neither side. So
Well, that's kind of almost the way it's happened in Afghanistan
yeah,
in some
yeah.
of those places.
Yeah.
You know, we have a peace thing, and then we leave, and then you come back in.
Verbal agreements, no, only as good as the paper it's written on.
It's written on, yeah, and maybe not that.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Kissinger had a really good plan, and he was frustrated because Li Xuan wanted a military victory. He was first party secretary. He took over when Ho Chi Minh was mm-hmm. exiled and died, and then also General Giap was exiled.
But what's the difference between World War II, the way people were treated when they came back, and the difference between the people that came back from Vietnam?
Well, they're going to be more different. I mean, World War II, you came back, you were a hero. They had every town had a parade, and all the heroes. We're
ticker tape parade.
Ticker tape parade, yeah. Everyone, no one could do enough for you. When I got out, and this is typical, I was flown to the Philippines where I picked up gonorrhea. So we won't go into that.
Did you put it back down?
I did not. It was nasty. We're going to have to cut that out. Anyway, so then I was flown to Oakland, and we were fed a steak dinner, and I was rotated out of the military. I had a brand new uniform with my sergeant stripes, all my pins. I looked sharp, and I wore my. They said, "Don't wear your uniform because you will be attacked." So I wore my uniform anyway, and I was ignored or hostile looks.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got home, nobody wanted to talk to me about it. They didn't want to know about it. I was called a failure, a baby killer.
I've had several other persons who were told when they left when they left the base after they got back and went back to their hometown that they were should not wear their uniform.
Exactly.
And one friend in particular came back to Ellensburg. And he said, for the most part, with the people in the community, they were treated fairly well. But at the college, it was a different. And my mother took care of Veterans Affairs at Central and took care of and worked with all the Vietnam vets that were coming back to school on the GI Bill.
Sure. Yep.
And many of them had the same story, that they did not wear their uniform in class or anything like that.
Yeah, there were exceptions, obviously. If you were from a small town, it was very patriotic. You might have gotten some. But I never got anything, and so I left in late 68. I jumped a plane, went to London, met my friends there who sent me to Spain with a letter of introduction to a musician I was going to study with. And 7 years later, I came back. 68 to 75, I was out of the country because I could not handle that kind of hostility.
There's been some interesting studies of returning veterans, veterans from the Vietnam War, and those who most successfully reintegrated were Native Americans. They come out of a tribal culture that has a warrior sort of sense to it, and they were welcomed back as warriors. They were in a sense reintegrated into the tribal culture as honored veterans, but also a lot of PTSD kinds of activities took place to reintegrate those Native American troops.
You might want to
that
ask,
did not happen.
You might want to ask Billy Two Feathers about that. Mm-hmm.
And my friend, Alan Aronica, who was graduated in June of 66 and was in Vietnam by October of 66, was injured three times. And he is was very close to the Yakima tribe.
Right.
And talking to him, it does sound like he received support from that community.
Right.
And he was also one of the folks that I've interviewed of many that said, I mean, he was in the field. He was boots on the ground the entire time he was there. And, you know, they'd put him in the hospital for a few weeks, take out shrapnel, and he says he still has shrapnel, you know. And so I think that's interesting that tribal support.
Just one thing real quick. What's happened recently in the past 10 or 15 years is that Vietnam veterans have joined Facebook and all these social networks, and we're all together. And so we tell each other what we're proud of each other, and our Vietnamese friends who either live here or in Vietnam love us dearly. I have thousands of Vietnamese friends who, from Facebook, I've got 4,300 friends who think I'm a hero. And when we went over there in 2013, they couldn't do enough for us.
Is that why you don't answer your phone sometimes? Because you're responding to your 4,300 friends there.
4,300.
Yeah.
And well, I'm almost all Vietnam veterans. About three quarters of them are Vietnam veterans.
Well, I want to thank you guys for being here today. I have to say from the deepest part of my heart that I have learned so much, and I have such a deep respect for you guys. And consider it really an honor to be Chris's friend. He's a great guy, and we're going to go on, and that sounds good. So I guess I can say good night, Vietnam. Good night, Bashan.
Good morning, Vietnam.
Good morning, Vietnam. Yeah, thank you very much, and everybody have a great day, and we'll see you again next week.
Thank you.
To stream this or any other episode of Is Abled with Dr. Stephen W. Nurse, go to voiceofashon.org and look under the Shows tab.